Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. We're sitting alongside president and founder of the Hoban Law Group, Bob Hoban. Today, the topic of our discussion is math, science is science, and we are joined by the CEO of Aurelius Data, Julie Armstrong. Julie, thank you for being here with us this evening.
Hey, I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, absolutely. And if you would, we know that you are up in Montana. I don't think we've had a lot of folks on the Hoban Minute from Montana. So if you would, just give us a sense of what it's been like up north over the past couple months, how Montana responded to this pandemic at the beginning, and then how things are looking more recently.
Sure. Well, it's not surprising you haven't had anyone on. There's only 1.2 million people in Montana. Originally, we shut the state down pretty quickly. I normally go back and forth between California and Montana, and it turned out to be an incredible place to stay through the pandemic. We originally were plateaued at about 400 cases statewide for almost 4 months. And then as the summer has come upon us, people are on vacation and traveling. We jumped in about 5 weeks from 400 cases to, I'm looking at the latest numbers here, 1,371. And it's from people coming into the state believing that because we have a small population that they don't have to take precautions. And it's really just proven that you can't, there are a few things you can't overcome, math and gravity being two of those. And you know, epidemiology doesn't stop at borders. So we expect those numbers to go up even more over the next couple of weeks.
Well, Julie, this is certainly a topic and really a discussion that highlights pragmatism. And maybe if you would, for our listeners, give us a little bit of background on you, what you did prior to coming over to the cannabis or hemp industry, and then what ultimately drove you to beginning or joining Aurelius Data.
Yeah, so we founded Aurelius. We started going through numbers and looking at the landscape in 2018. I have two co-founders, and one of the things that we decided to pull together were our skill sets. I'm a pharmacist. One of my co-founders came out of Silicon Valley and startups and operations. Another one of my co-founders is a biochemist and chemical engineer and have been working with remediation of biomass and pulling chemical compounds out of what people traditionally believe is waste. And he was, I don't want to say gifted, but given a tremendous amount of hemp waste, which at the time was anything that was not flour. And he wanted to see what was valuable in that waste. And as we know, it's a very complex plant. It has a lot to offer. There are a tremendous amount of compounds that are used across all platforms. And from that point forward, he always knew that there's a tremendous amount of value in the entire supply chain, but it doesn't mean it's in demand. It doesn't mean that the market wants it. We started, I told him of my experience having been behind the pharmacy counter that people were turning to alternative medicine, we'll just call it that for lack of a better word, and no one was asking them what they were taking it for, or whether or not it was working. So there was just a tremendous amount of community information out there that had not been quantified, and we felt really strongly that taking the tact of understanding what people had been doing was just as important as trying to shove new protocols down their throats. So we came up with a business model that was based around data.
Well, that has been the sort of bottleneck, if you will, for this plant, not just because we don't have enough data, but because we have had regulatory and legal prohibitions in place for so long. And as this plant sort of comes out of the gray and into the light, and really gets more visibility and there's opportunities to validate what things do. My observation is, what I mean by what things do is, what does the plant material do? What impact does it have in the human body? What are you allowed to say about that impact? Those things are 100% foundational and, you know, baseline for folks that operate in the food, supplement, or drug space. But a lot of folks that came into the cannabis industry didn't have that background. So we've seen folks not quite understand where their product fits or what they're allowed to say or even where to go get that data. And that's been a challenge, and that's almost set the industry back. That's my observation. You've identified a need to provide that data. Do you find that more and more folks in the industry that have real ambition are relying on data versus on anecdotes and based on just what's already out there in the marketplace?
Well, you just identified another gray area. We tend to dismiss community-acquired protocols and anecdotal discussions with patients as not being valid. And the FDA now requires real-world data for phase one trials. It was something that they never did before. They used the gold standard of double-blind studies, but now they also require real-world data because we realize that studies are a point in time. It is, it's one look. It's not so much of a tracker, and we know that human beings are extremely complex. The one thing that we kind of, and you're going to laugh, is that the hippies kind of had it right. They knew that it worked, and they passed those traditions down. A lot of this medicine is based on ritual, and the reason why it is successful is because it is the only medicine someone is taking, so they know definitively whether or not it works. And especially in this country, most patients are polypharmacy. They're taking many things. So trying to determine what is actually working for him is a little bit of a wicked problem. The gray area you just kind of brought up was that most of the anecdotal evidence was completely dismissed, so nobody recorded it and quantified it. And we feel like that it is very valuable, that it validates whether or not something works or whether or not it should be pursued for research, or more importantly to us, is whether or not it's harmful or has side effects or contraindications.
Well, let's pick up on that as well, because as we know, and not to call it a fault, but people are very, very passionate about this plant and about this industry. And sometimes they let that passion blind them of their pragmatism. Let's maybe put it like that. And I know that your organization put out a piece in March that basically highlighted that THC should be avoided for COVID patients. And if you would, give us a little bit of context on that, the work that you put into developing that idea, and then the reaction that you saw from the industry, which, again, I think sometimes that passion, the topic of the discussion here is math, science is science. But if the math and the science show something that is true and it goes against what people are passionate about, they let it blind them a little bit. So that's a lot to throw at you, but I know you got it from here, Julie.
Well, you brought it up earlier when you said that the industry slid backwards a little bit by not recognizing the importance of agnostic data. The vape crisis was very detrimental to this industry, and it's probably not the fault of any of the science, but rather of the ambition of people trying to create a product. We call it pounding a square peg into a round hole. Let's create a product, and then we'll develop the customer base for it later. We'll figure that out later. What we determined was we have to look at both sides of the coin. If we want this to become a well-respected medical regimen, we need to determine what its highest and best use is and what it should be avoided, what patients should avoid it for what circumstance. And that's the same way we treat every medication and every medical regimen, period. And when I say regimen, I could be talking about diet, exercise, or medication. There's something appropriate for every patient. The industry is extremely passionate. They've been jaded. They've been treated terribly by regulatory body by, you know, maybe we're going to allow it, and then they pull it back, and, you know, they have probably very little faith in any kind of an authority figure or framework at this point in time. And I think that their way to contradict that antagonist view is to be extremely enthusiastic and over the top, and it's a miracle and it's going to cure everything. And the problem with that is that it's now widely available, which means anybody might have access to it without good information. It's different when it was pretty tough to get, right? It wasn't in the gas station, but now we have vape cartridges available in the gas stations. We know that quite often they're getting to underage people. We know quite often that they're being used by people that should not be using them. So anyway, we're pretty even-handed on the information we put out. And along those lines, when COVID came up, we thought we should probably do a literature review and see where the pitfalls might be and let people know so they can continue to use their medicine as much as possible, but to avoid it if they have this acute crisis of COVID. And what we discovered is that in SARS, MERS, and influenza A, the viral replication was increased almost by 50 times when THC was introduced into these mouse models. And we did further, I know people say mice aren't people, but mammals are mammals and science is science. And if it is a viral replication issue, we have to assume that it's going to be the same with COVID, as COVID is just another form of SARS. So we put that information and said, look, if you believe you have COVID, if you have symptoms of COVID, if you've been exposed during the acute phase of the disease, we would encourage you to either switch to low THC or no THC varieties or form factors, because we believe that it could make the disease significantly worse. Yes, it was not received very well, I will say that, but there's a lot of information that is coming out now that is corroborating that research. And the headlines that people are seeing right now that say cannabis is great for COVID, if you actually read the article, it is saying that we believe CBD can help you recover from COVID, and that it, all the good things that CBD does with neuroprotective qualities and anti-inflammatory qualities is only appropriate after you are in the recovery phase of COVID. So, you know, it's something that we're probably going to do an update on, just to let people know that we're still standing behind that research, and it's being corroborated by all these new sources, and that we still believe that CBD is appropriate. But yeah, there was a bit of backlash that came out of that one. And I have a feeling it's that we're going to see that more and more as more even-handed research comes out.
Yeah, I think that I think you're correct about that. I mean, when you closely examine what the plant can do, many of us understand so many possibilities there, and then some folks just want it to be the answer, the total health, cure or, you know, the provider of homeostasis in the human body. And those elements do exist, but science is science, right? There are data behind that. You can't just, you know, and even if the plant can do a particular thing, I guess this is the other thing that's lost. It's what parts of the plant, how does it get transferred into the human body to affect that when you don't have standardized dosing and so forth and so on. You know, Julie, we talked about the loss of Lester Grinspoon in the last week or two. And mm-hmm. I talked in particular to him about a family member as it relates to ADHD. And I read a study that talked about the use of cannabis for ADHD. And that came out of Southern California from Dr. Behrman and some other folks. Now, when it talked about it, what it didn't say, in a way that was at least understandable by your average person with no medical training, what is the manner in which if you wanted to try that with that family member, what's the manner that they use to you know, transfer the cannabinoids into the human body or isolate them or what was the formulation. None of that information was available. So even when you know that the plant can do all of these great things, or at least has those capabilities, it still comes down to what's the formulation, what parts of the plant, how is it introduced into the human body, so forth and so on. And that's driven by data and science. So as you've, you know, moved forward with your company, and move forward with the evolution of this industry, have you worked with any companies overseas that really view and take the topic of quote-unquote medical cannabis seriously? And I don't mean to malign the term, but in the United States, medical cannabis means a different thing. It really just means safe, consistent, quality access to a dispensary. It, while it has medicinal benefit, it doesn't necessarily have legally medicinal properties to how it's structured.
Correct. And I think what's really most, you know, just to give somebody a primer, what's really most interesting about cannabis and the endocannabinoid system is that it is a super highway for distribution. It's much like the lymph system. You can deliver a substance fairly quickly and fairly evenly across the body, and it will have a systemic effect. I know that we in America, we tend to want instant gratification. We want something fixed immediately, and we want something tangible in our hands, which is why when we leave the doctor's office, we want a prescription, right? We want to go and fill it, and we want to take one pill a day. And I think what we need to understand about cannabis is that the dosing is going to be different. You're going to be taking much smaller amounts more frequently instead of taking one bolus dose one time a day. I think that is what Israel has been doing for so long, is that they have been trying to correlate symptom relief to specific compound combinations from the plant. And that's what our interest is. We want to know, we do realize that cannabis is probably not going to change the course of disease, but that it definitely will provide symptom resolution for symptoms that, you know, and completely resolve those symptoms, but not permanently.
Well, let me ask you this. Given that do genetics matter from your perspective, or is it simply the combination of the specific ratios of cannabinoids in some sort of formulation, or is it a little bit of both? Because there's a great debate in this industry about whether you can, you know, create a formulation from isolated or concentrated individual right. cannabinoids and terpenes versus what's in the genetics themselves. Not to take you terribly off topic, but I'd love your perspective on that point.
So when we talk about genetics, I think about genetics, you know, at a human level, and you're talking about genetics on the phenotype of the plant. I do believe that full spectrum is necessary, because I believe that the lock and keys that unlocks the different abilities of the plant to operate in an environment, just like DNA has a companion protein. But I think that we don't know, right? I believe you have to look at we have Saul Kay on our advisory board, and he's completely tied into what is going on in Israel and all the research, and they have been at research intensively for the last 40 years, and they still don't know, right? I know that he reached out to Dr. Msholem when we put out our paper on COVID, and he absolutely agreed with it and said, you know, there may be potential, but we don't know. And if we know that there's harm, then as a medical professional, your edict is to do no harm, right? So that's your first order of business, is to make sure something doesn't harm someone, and then we'll continue to look at the benefits. I think from all the research they've done is that if you can concentrate a couple compounds that you know are very effective for symptom relief, you still need to include some constituency of the full spectrum product. The concentration of the full spectrum constituents doesn't have to be, you know, at the same level as the compounds that you're using to treat something, but it is necessary. The golden ratio of the compounds in the plant is there for a reason. And that ratio allowed it to survive for as long as it has. I mean, I'm not a botanist, but I do know that plants create things to either attract animals or repel animals, right? And so we've had a little bit of an issue when people start concentrating terpenes. It's probably not the best thing to do, right? I mean, it may make something smell very good, but if you want a human being to consume it and it wasn't that way naturally, we're guessing it's probably going to give you some gastric distress, right? Or it's going to cause some issues because that was not what nature intended and it wasn't what nature, you know, put out there. If we're talking about human genetics, that's kind of something we kick around a lot when people say, well, I have my genetics done and, you know, your genetics are the same now as they were when you were a baby. That hasn't changed. What has changed is your endocrine profile, your hormone profile, your diet, all of those things, the way, the way you metabolize certain things and the way you express certain proteins is probably the same, but everybody, there's so many different factors we have to look at, you know, whether you drink 5 cups of coffee a day or whether or not you drink alcohol and maybe you take a statin or maybe you take lisinopril, something else, right? Those all make a significant difference when you're using other medications. And so those are the things we really look at more than the genetics of the plant or the human being.
There's so many fascinating points in there, Julie. And I think up until this point, we've really highlighted the science of science. And I want to put one more thing to you before we sign off that really highlights the math is math. And this is something that Bob and I have talked about a lot and something that came up when I spoke to you previously, which is you look at all the acreage for hemp being grown in the United States, and then you look at the percentages that groups like the Jacobson or the Hemp Industry Daily, whoever, puts out about what percentage is being grown for CBD. And you have to really ask yourself, with 100,000 or more acres of hemp being grown and 90% of it being grown for CBD or 80%, whatever it is, isn't that way too much supply? Is the demand really that high? How much hemp would you really need to grow when you extract those cannabinoids out of it to formulate and create all of the products that are out there? It's just wild. It does seem, when you just break it down in the math and the numbers, that our supply is so much astronomically higher than the demand when you think about how much cannabinoids you can extract out of a crop.
Well, Eric, just quickly to that point, you know, some of the leading CBD companies, certainly the Colorado-based ones, they grow their own product, and they grow it on a very modest field or sometimes year-round indoors. It does not take a large footprint to produce all the cannabinoids necessary for some of the largest distributing CBD companies in the world. So to your point, where is all this this production going to go? And Julie, what do we really need?
Well, so this is, I have to give credit to my brilliant co-founder, James Stevens. When we sat down in October of 2018 and we were going to create, we wanted to look, Montana has a tremendous amount of hemp in the ground. Some of it is test crop. Some of it is, there are farmers that aren't getting subsidies anymore, so they are trying to grow some different crops. But we have quite a bit in the ground. We worked out the math on the whiteboard, and I still have a picture of it, where he said at the current demand, and if we increase that demand by 8 to 10% a year over, you know, until 2030, and the amount of product that a human being should take, right, to control general conditions or for certain symptom resolution, he worked everything out, and he worked out all the numbers, and he said, you know, we really only need 254 acres of hemp. He said if it was extracted with the best case and extracted with clean and good manufacturing practices with food grade equipment, he goes, that's really all we would need. And so from that point forward, we looked at the market and we said, anybody who's in manufacturing and production right now is going to lose their socks because this is just in the U.S. This is not what's coming up from South America and even from the Congo and Africa. They're producing their own. So, I mean, it's just math. The bottom's going to drop out at a certain point. The more states that come online, the more people that are putting it in the ground, the more people are doing indoor grows, there's only so much of a market for it. But then I think you have to look and see what the industrial uses are. You know, maybe the highest and best use for a hemp crop is remediating the soil and turning it over for another pulse crop. Or maybe it eliminates pesticides. You know, that's not really my area. James is working on the industrial side of things with hempcrete and you know, they've done tons of case studies and test products, but, you know, growing it for medicinal use is probably at its end at this point. I think there's probably enough in the ground and enough that's being extracted and produced. But, you know, and the recreational market will always have, a solid place here in this country. But again, we just see the price dropping out, you know, and it makes me very nervous for all those folks that have storefronts right now and are opening up new vertical operations. And it makes me really nervous for, it makes me see them as a very ripe target for consolidation. You know, they're building up the infrastructure and someone's just going to come in when the price drops out and snap everybody up.
Consolidation usually is like chapter 3 or chapter 4 of every book. That covers every industry, so it's bound to happen. But it is unfortunate, given the fact that, you know, there's just a lack of central clearinghouse for that data, so people can understand and make those decisions going in about what capacity is by region versus just going in on a whim that this is the next big thing. And unfortunately, that's about the extent of the due diligence that we've seen. Or to your point, somebody goes out and evaluates and says, based on the genetics, based genetics of the plant material, based on the mathematics and the acreage, I can yield this much conservatively, which will in turn provide me with this much material and this much refined material. But the missing component there is context. There are, you know, 15 per people for every one person with that exact same plan, and all 15 times 15 times 15 again can't succeed in the same supply chain.
Well, then you fall into that trap of trying to produce a very specific thing for a very specific condition, and there may only be so many patients, right? And then, you know, then the plant is not useful for anything else at that point, right? If you produce a particular phenotype with, let's say, a terpene and, you know, acetylcholine and delta-8 or something, right? And we know that it treats a specific condition, but it probably is not going to be effective for much else. So if you don't hit that target market, or you're not able to get that distributed to those patients or to those consumers, you know, you've made a very large investment and it fell flat. You know, the other thing, and we were talking about this yesterday, there are 11,000 patents out there, and they are all owned in general by Big Pharma, and they've owned them for a very long time. So all these folks that believe they're going to patent something that's a unicorn, right? It's probably already been patented and it's owned by somebody else. I think the highest and best use of trying to figure out is not to try and come up with a brand new compound combination or a brand new molecule that you think that you're going to own and ring fence, but it's probably trying to determine other uses for that, whether it's medical or if it is cosmetic, things like that. And that's why I think that people from the consumer packaged goods industry are going to dominate, and probably in short term, probably in the next 24 months, we're going to see a tremendous amount of turnover from the very large corporations coming in and starting to find new uses for all of these things. So that's why we feel like data is king right now. We feel like understanding how and why people are using things, at what frequency, what the barriers are, what their pain points are, and truly understanding it, starting with medical information, and then moving to other uses, right, for just wellness and health is probably the only game in town. I hope we're right. It's going to be upsetting if we're not, but there's going to be a watershed moment here pretty soon, and I don't know whether it's going to be the price point dropping out or if it's going to be legalization. And I think the moment that happens, you're going to see all the very large corporations coming in and just kind of wiping everybody off the map. It's just been something that's been very heavy on our minds.
Well, we certainly are grateful to have you on here to share your perspective with us. I think all your points are excellent and your thinking is right in line. And something for our listeners to look forward to is in the near future, we will have your co-founder, James Stevens, on for a conversation really focused on agronomy and the agricultural component of industrial hemp. But Julie, it's been a pleasure to talk with you today. We're so happy to have had you on, and we can't wait to talk to you again soon.
Well, thanks for letting me expound and give you the report here from Montana.
Much appreciated, Julie. Thank you very much.
thank you for listening to this episode of the Hoban Minute. Do you have any ideas for episode topics or guests? We would like to hear from you. Reach out to us at media@hoban.law and stay tuned for more on the Hoban Minute.